And here we are, class four. And so now we are doing the deep dive in to the actual tantric aspects of things. So the first 3 weeks we've had a look at what Tantra, how it fits into the Buddhist path, and then an overview of Buddhism. And now we're going to dive into the tantric path of things. So I think we'll just start with setting our motivation and becoming present and being really, oh, sorry, that was me. I'm just trashing the joint.
I haven't got your headset yet.
No, but I don't think we need it today. Okay, so right. we can save the gaff tape. So how lucky that we're here and that we're able to meet again just a mere week later. And so we can kind of feel really fortunate. We often forget how fortunate that we are in the sense of feeling lucky. That thanks to all of our previous lives' hard work, we find ourselves here in the very best possible situation to be able to benefit all sentient beings in the very best possible way. So what a happy confluence of circumstances. So to remember this and to refresh our bodhicitta intention and motivation, why are we here? Not just for our own benefit. Our own benefit is, you know, maybe where we start with, but actually what really propels us and sustains us is because what about all the rest of the sentient beings? And so where many times we mightn't make the effort if it's just for ourselves, when we look around us and see all the suffering sentient beings, and we can't even bear to see the suffering, then we know we have to do something. And so what we're going to do is take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for the specific purpose of becoming Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for all sentient beings. So refuge in bodhicitta, let's do this in the Tibetan. Sangye Chiran Sogye Chanam Lai Chanchur Badu Dani Kyapsui Chi Dagi Chanye Gyape Sonam Gye Trala Panje Sangye Dropa Sho Sangye Chiran Sogye Chanam Lai Chanchur Badu Dani Kyapsui Chi Dagi chenye gepe sonam gi drala panche sangye dropa shon. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. The seven limb prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. And then offering a mandala. Wasaji po ki chushimeton tram rirablin ji nite kyam pai di sangye jindu mi te o wan yi dro ko nam dan shin la cho pai sho yi dang guru rana mandala kam ni atayami. I think that our mandala is very joyously accepted by Guru Vajradhara, the tantric manifestation of the Buddha. And so now that we've done our preparation to make sure that we have a altruistic motivation, biggest, best possible intention, let's have a look what we've already covered really quickly. Six names of Tantra. So we've looked at the first class, we looked at what Tantra is and what makes it unique. And so the little acronym for that was Secret Mr. Vajra and his Method Canon. So the main thing about the tantric path being secret, so that it's not misused, and so that we ourselves don't get into trouble. So it's like, just like the plans to a nuclear power plant are kept secret for a very good reason, to protect everybody. So similar for this. The path of mantra being the Mahayana mantra, quite different path from Mahayana Sutra. The resultant vehicle, meaning that you practice the future result now. So instead of a step-by-step from here to enlightenment, it's like starting with enlightenment, and eventually the two match up. Vajra, meaning the indestructible purity of the mind, and this continuity of the mind from here to Buddhahood. So it's not that we turn into anything else. It's because of the completely pure nature of our mind that Buddhahood is possible. And then all the many methods utilized in this vehicle of Tantra, and that's what we'll have a look at today. How everything can be used on the path. And then the canon of the Vijadharas, meaning the wisdom holders, especially of long life practices, because we need to have a really long life to be able to actually become a Buddha in one lifetime. So then we looked at how the whole thing of Buddhist Tantra, what makes it Buddhist, isn't the Tantra part. It's the three principal aspects of the path. That's what makes it Buddhist. Because Tantra is like it's using the system of our body-mind complex, and many religions use that system. But Buddhist Tantra is the only one that aims to become a Buddha. And then we looked at the qualities that we need as a student, and then after we've got our own house in order, what we look for in a guru, in a Vajra master. Because once you take a guru, then there's no turning back. You can't have doubts then. Then once you've devoted yourself and made that informed decision, then any doubts that you have is actually a downfall. So for that, we've got to really check out very quickly in the beginning. And then last week we looked at the three gates to enter Tantra. Does anyone remember what they are? Yes, bodhicitta, that's which gate? The second gate, that's right. So we're in the Badlands, and then what's the first gate that we enter through? That's it. We just did it at the beginning of the class, refuge. And then once we enter through refuge, then we enter through the gate, bodhicitta gate, into the path of the Mahayana. And then within that, the inner gate, empowerment. Yes, very good. So just like going through these three gates to get to the castle in the middle with Vajradhara in the middle, is it possible, for instance, to take a tantric initiation and not be a Buddhist? Do you have to be a Buddhist to take an initiation?
You'd have to be? Take refuge.
Because you have to take refuge, that's right. Yes, and so like in the olden days, sometimes various lamas would come out and they'd give you an initiation, and it's all in Tibetan and there's hardly any translation. And so a whole lot of people would be there not knowing what they're doing or anything, and then afterwards go, oh yeah, that was nice, but not sure if I'm a Buddhist or not. It's like, you've just signed up for something. So now we're far more educated about it, which is very good. So what we're looking at today then, how much bliss can we handle before we go berserk? So we might think, oh yeah, we can, but you know, how much desirous energy, how much of a good time can you handle before you get overwhelmed or go berserk? So one way that we can approach this is by thinking, many of us know what our pain threshold is. So we know how much pain, like a blister or walking with a stone in your shoe or sitting uncomfortably for meditation, like we know what our pain threshold is, and we know when we're approaching the edge of it and we're about to tip over and we're just like, yeah. And the really good thing about a pain threshold is that because it's unpleasant, we have to do something about it. And so we're much more aware. And then what happens when we're reaching our pain threshold? What are some of the things that we do?
Movement.
So we try and get rid of it, or
lots of thoughts.
Yeah.
What do I do here? Is it okay to get up?
Lots of thoughts. What do I do? All the different, you know, just one more minute, just one more step, all of those things. So with the pain threshold, we're quite aware of it, and we can give a scale of what, you know, in a hospital when you go and they say on it's 1 to 10. But how much do we know about our pleasure threshold before we go, before we get overwhelmed? When we get overwhelmed by all the enjoyments that come in through the senses, do we even know we're getting overwhelmed? Or do we just go like get completely drunk on good music or good food or good sex or good drugs or whatever it is? Because there's a pleasure threshold as well. So if we aren't aware of it, it's very difficult to be able to harness all of the pleasurable experiences on the path to enlightenment. It's actually easier to harness painful experiences on the path to enlightenment, which we do in the thought transformation teachings. We use all of those unpleasant experiences, and it helps us focus on Tonglen, on bodhicitta, on developing compassion for others who are in worse situation than us. We have a real incentive. But there's no incentive when it comes to pleasurable things. We just like sit back and enjoy them till they're over. Yeah, if we're being consumerist about it, all those pleasurable things are over, and then what? But at the time, does it ever occur to us, what can I use this for? How can I use this fantastic experience to benefit all sentient beings on the path to enlightenment? Yes, so that's the thing. So normally in Mahayana Sutra, we pull it back. So in Mahayana Tantra, it's really looking at how do we actually utilize desire and pleasure on the path. And so part of it is knowing what our pleasure threshold is before we go berserk. The whole tantric approach, remember, it's many methods. So it's using every single emotion and experience that we have on the path to enlightenment, not just the bad ones, which we've done in the previous units of transforming problems into happiness, but now also the good ones. And so what this, how this is explained is in the four classes of Tantra. And so what those, when we hear about lower tantras or highest yoga tantra, those different classes of tantra, what makes them a higher or lower class is our capacity to handle pleasure. That's what distinguishes it. Before we get into that, I wanted to hear about the smelling homework. Did anyone remember to do it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So what happened? Tell me, what was your thing with the smelling homework? In fact,
I just ate.
Okay, so really basic, just hungry and then ate. Yep, and no problem at all. What do you think would have happened if you couldn't have eaten, if you had have like been carrying your dinner to the couch and it tipped over?
Pretty drunk.
So there you go. So then because the hunger can be satiated, then no problem. But yeah, that's right. So what about you, Alison? How did you go with the smelling homework?
Amazingly, I...
Oh, okay. So you put it off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like I was thinking I needed to put it off for a while, not just...
Well, yeah, you did have to pause to be able to see what was going on in your mind. So you just...
It was okay.
Put the pause in before.
Quite a big
fight. Uh-huh. Yeah, so that happens to me. I just forgot to do it because I just like the thought to eat and then the eating, there's like so no little gap in there at all. Like how much mindfulness is in there? Mostly none. There is the attachment and everything associated with it.
Yeah. So attachment to food is not so
right. And then Camille, did you do the smelling homework? So you can still smell from seven years old. Yeah.
Moment and smell.
Yep. And then did you eat it? Were you able to eat it or not?
Oh, yes, but I had to.
So how did you restrain yourself? What did you do? How did you do it?
The restraint was more.
Okay, so there was fear, there was the restraint, fear, external restraint from your parents.
Then
did you eat it?
It was a reminder restraint. It wasn't like with a whip or anything, but it was part of a training.
Did you enjoy it though, then, or not? What was better, the eating or the smell?
I down to eat, oh boy, did I enjoy it, but the birds.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Another thing is they gave me pot.
So let's leave that there, Camille, and I wanted to let's fit this all in because all of our responses to eating and wanting. No, I think we all fall in the spectrum. So what we normally have, we start off with just a worldly thing, which is we're hungry. We actually are in a state of dissatisfaction and we don't actually really notice until we smell something.
Yeah.
And then that triggers us to have this, we have the craving and the grasping. And the thing about this is that we think the happiness is out there in the thing. It's in the baguette.
Yes, it's in the baguette.
It's in the food. And so then whilst we can get the baguette, everything is fine. And so then we go along and we think this is all great and this is how we get our pleasure. And that would work if we could always get that baguette. But sometimes we can't. We have to fast or you drop your dinner or something like that. Or we have an intolerance to gluten. No more baguettes. Now what? Does that mean I'll never be happy again? So this is like the really basic thing. The worldly one works whilst we can continuously feed the monster, but it's not a long-term solution. And then the next kind of stage is like the Hinayana stage where we restrain ourselves. And so then there's all the different tricks that we use to restrain ourselves. We remove ourselves physically, like Alison, you're saying, you go and you do something else for a while and then, you know, the urge goes, the smell's not there, or you talk yourself out of, I didn't want it anyway, or I'm not really hungry anyway, all of these little tricks that we do. Or we have a mindfulness practice to slow it all down. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, go for it, yeah. Ah, okay, so yeah, so dropping the grasping, which is like this Hinayana approach of restraining the mind, it gives us freedom because now instead of being beholden to the baguette, now we're free, yep. Anyone else?
Yeah, I'm just going to try and do that.
Oh, no, that's right. So what if you lose, if you've been sick and you lose your sense of taste and smell, then what do? So then, again, it's like we are beholden to the external circumstances for stimulation. What do we do if we no longer have those circumstances? What about what's happening within? So normally we come to this restraining the mind. And then kind of middle scope would come along and would start actually looking at, well, what's the nature of smell anyway? What's the nature of hunger? Does the satisfaction come from outside? What are all the dependencies to make smell happen? Dependent arising. So we can do a little bit of a you know, an emptiness meditation, how the smell doesn't actually inherently exist and neither does the hunger. It all depends. You know, and many people that are like on crash diets and things, they take, you know, the hunger is something to battle and then to find strength about, all that kind of stuff. So that's much more on this Hinayana kind of restraining the mind. But then the perfection vehicle, actually, the focus isn't so much on restraint but on using it for others. So that would be things like thinking, wow, just like I'm enjoying this dinner, may everybody enjoy this dinner. Or just like I'm so fortunate to have this, I wish everybody else was so fortunate. So that's the beginnings, that's, you know, of compassion. And then you can take it to bodhicitta and you go, and may I be the one to provide every single sentient being with safety and sustenance. Well, that's right. You could think, oh no, we've run out of milk, I can't bear it. Or you can think, oh, there's all these extra people on the island, at least somebody's got milk, yeah, even though I haven't. So that we can adjust it. So it's still based on restraint. We're still restraining the mind, but now we're thinking of others. And we can also do things like, you know, just like I'm enjoying this smell, that's because I have this perfect human rebirth and I can do all of these things. May I make the most of my life for others, offer the smell for the benefit of others, give the food away for the benefit of others, and all thinking by this, may I attain enlightenment for the benefit of everybody. We could also think from the emptiness side of things, you know, this smell is nice, not because it's nice from its own side, but because that's the result of my virtue. Anything that we experience as pleasurable is the result of our virtue. It's not because of the thing itself. Then the next thing is mantra. So this is where it's still based on restraint and it's still based on sharing and the big-hearted altruistic attitude. It still has the Buddhist view of dependent arising, but now we're enjoying it as well as meditating on emptiness at the same time. So you experience it as blissful without believing the story. And you spontaneously offer to everybody, and everybody who you're offering to are all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And every single blissful experience or every single delicious smell reminds you of the blissful clarity of the mind. So instead of going into the external thing, I want that thing, that smell, it reminds you of the nature of your own mind. And so then, whether it's the smell of a delicious cake or coffee, or whether it's the smell of a dog shit, you're still going to go, beautiful, because it's not from the thing out there. So you can see there is a huge range, and I find coming back to this analogy again and again so helpful because of the way that we normally go through things. We usually stop around about at that Hinayana level of just kind of restraining the mind without, you know, and then with some training we start trying to bring in the altruism, but very rarely do we go to this blissful play of appearances. So with this as a background, because it's just so tangible, then let's have a look at how Tantra uses desire as fuel. And something from the Lama Yeshe book, Introduction to Tantra. Okay. So this sets the scene. As human beings, we have the capacity to enjoy limitless, blissful happiness, while at the same time remaining free of the delusions that normally contaminate our pursuit of pleasure. Contrary to what some people might believe, there is nothing wrong with having pleasures and enjoyments. What is wrong is the confused way we grasp onto these pleasures, turning them from a source of happiness into a source of pain and dissatisfaction. It's such grasping and attachment that's the problem, not the pleasures themselves. Therefore, if we could free ourselves from this habitual grasping, we could enjoy ourselves as much as we want without any of the difficulties that usually accompany our ordinary compulsive search for pleasure. So the whole way that this smelling exercise came about was because years ago, me and Jordan, we went off to a Roma Street multicultural festival, all this incredible music from around the world. And we really wanted to hear all of these Balkan bands and a Sufi band and a this and a that and whatever. And then we got there and we didn't have any money. And we forgot that accompanying all of these bands from all around the world were food trucks from all around the world. And it was just this barrage of delicious smells. And we didn't have a cent. And we're like, how are we going to enjoy all of this music all day with all of these smells? Like, we're just going to go insane. So we had to do something. And so it was Jordan's idea just to, every time we had a smell, we just go, how wonderful, without going to the next, which is I want it. So, well, it is. It's the particles coming into your nose and your tongue, but it doesn't absolve the hunger. So we have the experience of pleasure, and then the next moment is the concretizing it, that it comes from out there, and then wanting to grasp it and possess it. So breaking that off to just enjoy it without needing to possess it was one thing. And then looking at the experience of, you know, like with the fasting, of the pain of hunger, and then not taking that personally, because often when we're hungry and we can't eat, we get upset on top of it. And those two things don't go together either. Just like when it's delicious smells, you don't necessarily have to have it. So it was a very profound day, plus the bands were incredible. and it went for hours and hours and hours. So we had many opportunities to practice this and a really good incentive, which was just this really tangible thing of, do we want to have a good time or a bad time? So I think it was actually a very deep meditation experience that we had. Anyway, so Lamyashi says, with the proper understanding of transformation, whatever we do 24 hours a day can bring us closer to our goal of totality and fulfillment. All of our actions, walking, eating, and even urinating, can be brought onto the spiritual path. So perhaps all this sounds impossible. Certainly other more gradual spiritual approaches stress that desire, jealousy, and other delusions of our daily life are impure and should be treated as poisons. We're constantly reminded of their dangerous effects and are instructed to avoid their influence as much as possible. But Tantra takes a different approach. Although it also insists that delusions such as desirous attachment are the source of our dissatisfaction and suffering and therefore must be overcome, it teaches skillful ways of using the energy of these delusions to deepen our awareness and spiritual progress. So, desire as fuel, so Lamyashi also says, when the intense energy of bliss is focused on emptiness, it gives rise to the wisdom that cuts the root of suffering. So what we're doing here, when we're using this, so it's desirous energy, but it's also the energy of experiencing pleasure, any kind of pleasure from the senses. We're using that instead of to entertain ourselves as a consumerist kind of experience, we're using it as fuel to focus on emptiness. So whilst we still have attachment, we'll never be able to do that. We'll get sucked into just enjoying the experience, grasping after it, wanting more of it, being upset when it comes to an end, thinking that it comes from out there, all of those things. So we really have to have that strong basis of the lower vehicles. Then once we can handle it, then we use all of that intense energy to focus on emptiness. So Lamyashi also points out that with ordinary pleasures, food, sex, drugs, music, entertainment, all of those things, because we think the happiness comes from out there,
Or as B. Allen Wallace says, the happiness is in the thing. Because we think the happiness is in the thing, our attention gets really tunnel vision. It gets really focused onto that external thing. We think that without that thing, we can't be happy. So the flavor, the experience of that is very paranoid. And because we live in a fairly affluent society and, you know, we have a social safety net and all of those things, most of the time we can adjust things and feel okay. And it's only when suddenly we can't get those things, when the cost of living starts to bite, where we can't have the delicious cake, where the things run out, that's when we first notice there's a problem with this. But up until then, we haven't even seen there's a problem. So it's completely different from the tantric approach, which actually expands the mind. It relaxes the mind. So even the difference between us having an enjoyable or entertaining experience and wanting more, or the difference between having an enjoyable experience and wanting to share it with others, just on a worldly level, is completely different. The whole flavor of it. So what we're doing, we're using the energy to overcome our worldly limitations, our grasping at inherence. So I might be tempted to go, oh, great, so this is the path of fun. Give me more. Have a totally materialistic view of it all, but we'll really get into trouble then. So far, so good. Questions? Comments? Anything online? No? So I thought I'd give you some, also another example now, because many of the depictions of Tantra are depicted in the Buddhist art of union, of the male and female deities or Buddhas in union. So Lama Yeshe says, within us all is an unlimited source of male and female energy, just as within every atom is the potential for nuclear fission. So one of the things that we notice when we look at the iconography, the male and female Buddhas in embrace, we think it's two, but actually it's one. It's one, but it's showing two different aspects, masculine and feminine. So it's one Buddha, but depicting these aspects. So the masculine is often is representing skillful means, compassionate action, all the different ways of helping sentient beings, and the energy of bliss. And then the feminine represents is the wisdom. So often in this embrace, it's called the, you know, whatever deity and the wisdom mother. And so it's those two together, unified, masculine and feminine. And so we ourselves, we have the very beginnings of this unification, but we get it really wrong. So has anyone ever been in a relationship or wanted to find a perfect man or a perfect woman? Have you ever had that longing? Can you remember back?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you have? Okay. That's right. We were told it's a thing. And again, we think it's a thing out there. We're looking for it out there. So we have this, no one has to be taught that longing. We have a longing for connection. We have a longing for union. We have a longing to meet the perfect one. And that's like the very beginnings of it. But because we jump straight into thinking it's out there, it's all over. Like, that way there's problems. And so often what we'll do is we'll have a few relationships like that. We'll think this is the one. We'll get so invested in it, and then our hopes will be dashed. Our heart will be broken. We'll go, I can never go through this again. It was far too painful. And the conclusion we come to is, that's it, I'm not having relationships anymore. Did anyone ever come to that point?
Yeah.
kind of, maybe. Like, that's it. I'm done with the relationships. So it's from one extreme, got to find the one, all those TV shows, Farmer Wants a Wife and The Bachelorette and all of that. It's all about the one. And then you go, no, can't be found that way, until you go to the other extreme. That's it. I'm never having a relationship again. And both of them are wrong. So actually, we miss the bit in the middle, which is this longing for union. What is that actually? So in psychological terms, you could think of it as a sublimated yearning for enlightenment. That's actually what we're longing for, but we don't know it. We don't even know it exists. So we don't have to get rid of that longing for union. We just have to get intelligent about it and actually see, what is it really? So like Lamyoshi says, within us, there is actually this unlimited source of male and female energy. It's just that it's not unified. It's not harnessed. We're disconnected from it. And so all of this iconography, it's not about sexuality and it's not about gender. And it's not about relationships, it's about energy and actually about unifying our own energies. And if we do that, then we won't ever feel lonely or disconnected. So there is another difference too, because with ordinary relationships, if we follow ordinary relationships as a refuge, we'll just get into trouble unless they're enlightened. And even then, if we're not enlightened, we're still going to get unhappy, aren't we? So it's very difficult to find our happiness in that way. Whereas if you follow this longing for union on a meditational deity, there isn't any of the problems of interpersonal relationships. And actually, it's a realistic projection, because what we're projecting is our own wholeness and totality. And that is actually something that's achievable. So it mirrors our potential. So, questions, comments? Yeah, I think Jung's idea of individuation was this, again, that's almost like a yearning for enlightenment, but that might be more a yearning for nirvana, whereas this one's more. This is far more unifying all of those energies. But there are similarities. But, of course, with Jung as well, he didn't have that view of emptiness. Yeah, so I can only tell you a story really on this one. So when one relationship that I was in Melbourne, a very intense relationship with a poet, and so it came to an end, of course, and I was devastated, and I was so unhappy, and I started realizing, I went through this whole thing about whether it was ever worth having relationships or not. And I actually started analysing, where did my longing come from and what was I actually longing for? And then I realised I wasn't actually longing for that person or even for a relationship. And that the only thing that I could put it on was that I was actually longing for everlasting happiness and connection and meaning. And then I thought, well, what's that? Well, that's Tara. So actually, I'm longing for Arya Tara, and I just got sidetracked and thought it was my boyfriend. And of course, he can't fulfill that. What am I really longing for? So I was able to join the dots and see actually that longing can take you all the way to enlightenment if you don't get sidetracked on the externals. And so with these deity practices, you can have all of those experiences of being loved and feeling good with the deity. And because the deity, even though it starts off as being in imagination, it's something that accords with reality. Whereas when we have a relationship with another human being, we've got this idea of them and it doesn't actually accord with reality at all. And that's where the problems come in. So that's just one aspect of it. There is more, which comes much more to do with High Yoga Tantra, but this is just like an overall view. And because it's like our you know, deepest yearnings is for connection and relationship. That's why it's depicted like this. So you'll have to stay tuned for the rest of it. So this takes us to the tantric approach. So there are a couple of examples, analogies. So one of them is like an insect. So the tantric approach is like an insect that's born from wood and devours the wood, devours it from inside, sustaining itself until the wood's gone. So white ants or whatever kind of ants. This is one of the classic analogies of the tantric approach. And so what that kind of represents is that we're born in the desire realm. We're born from attachment. We're the result of attachment and virtue. And so instead of fighting against the energy of attachment, we use it to progress us towards enlightenment. So we use the energy of attachment to get rid of the attachment. So actually, technically, when they say Tantra is the practices utilizing desire, that's not true. That's just like shorthand. What it is Tantra is the practices utilizing the bliss that arises from desire. Because you can't utilize a distorted mind. Desirous attachment is a distorted mind. You can't utilize an affliction on the path to enlightenment. But you can utilize the energy of it, not the affliction, but the energy of it. So even though we're using attachment to get rid of attachment, the shorthand way of saying it, or we're using the pleasurable experiences that arise from attachment to get rid of attachment, we're still getting rid of attachment. We're not making more attachment. So this is really important to remember. Tantra is not a method to increase one's desire or attachment, but it eliminates it. It's just how we do it. And that's why I really wanted us to do that smelling homework, because right there we can see what our relationship with attachment is. And we can have all these nice ideas, but when it comes to smell and food and hunger, it's like it's laid out there for us, clear as day. Bit of a rude awakening for me. It's like I've got a long way to go. So the whole point is to become free of all the afflictions and especially attachment, because that's the one that really keeps us stuck to samsara. Does Sue have a question about this?
No, but
lovely, meticulous Sue.
No, she hasn't, but Anthea did have a question, but then you went straight on to talk to her question and you answered it exactly.
Okie dokie. So this is one analogy. Then I thought we'll just do a little bit on how does this actually work? This is the most esoteric slide of the entire class, so don't worry. But it just gives you a flow chart. Because, and the reason why I put this in here is that it's not hit and miss. This whole tantric system is precision work. And it's precision work like if you're building a nuclear power plant. It's not, let's just try this and let's sticky tape this together and whatever. Like everything is meticulously done. And we know what happens when a nuclear power plant gets into the wrong hands, which we're seeing, you know, in Ukraine. It's a really dodgy situation. So here we're working with the nuclear power plant within our own body, all of the elements within our own body. It's fine and meticulous work. And there's a lot in our culture where we've been very slapdash about using the energies in our bodies. So a whole lot of experimentation with drugs without the cultural underpinnings to keep it safe. Whole lot of experimenting with yoga and breathing techniques and all sorts of things to, like, you know, create your own inner drug. all the experiences that comes from the weird anti-psychiatry movement of happenings and, you know, harnessing all the weirdness in the world, a lot of that comes from just experimenting. And it's really like us white Ingies, we just dive in there and we go, oh, this looks like fun, and we just chuck it all around. And actually it's a very, very precise, it's a precise path. And if we go in there thinking, oh, let's give this a go, or let's experiment with that, we can really get into trouble. And a lot of Westerners have done this and gotten into trouble. So we don't want to do that. So it's worth recognizing that this is a system that's been going for hundreds of years, and you can become a Buddha from it. And it has happened before, and we don't have to invent it or discover it ourselves. We just have to follow the instructions. And that could be one of the things about smelling homework too, Alison, that just being able to follow the instructions is a big deal. And it's not easy. It's not easy to even hear an instruction, let alone follow them. So even there, we're on the back foot. And part of, I mean, that's part of why we have, you know, that game, Afflictions to Perfections, is just to be able to follow instructions and get used to doing that without being upset. So even just the really basic things, equanimity, following the instructions. So I remember getting, when we were renovating, getting a thing for to put the varnish on the floor, and on the tin, on the lid of the tin, pressed into it three-dimensionally was, if all else fails, follow the instructions. Oh man, it should be a plaque on the wall. So this is the flowchart. So we have, during meditation, we make the energy of desire manifest. So what that means is, in meditation, you have been able to concentrate your mind enough that you can reach a state pretty much of calm abiding, single-pointed concentration without any effort. And when you can do that, then naturally your body and mind become relaxed, blissful, pliant. All of those energies are flowing very well. And then, because you have single-pointed concentration and aren't distracted by attachments and grasping after all the external things, you can actually manipulate the energies in your body. You can manipulate the chakras and the energies that flow through them. So then, through the power of all of this energy flowing through your body, manifest desire or pleasurable experiences of all of that energy flowing through your body, you enter a blissful state. You experience bliss. And because we've got the underpinning of the three principal aspects of the path, instead of just getting involved in that and as entertainment, we use that blissful state of mind to meditate on emptiness. So you can join bliss with the correct view. So as a way to understand how powerful this is just think about something that you love doing, and how, because you love doing it, you can do it for a long time. Like, I love crochet, and I can crochet for hours and hours, and I enjoy it. You might love horse riding or computer programming or baking cookies, or, you know, so anything that we love doing, and often it's something that we are good at already, so we don't have to force ourselves and think, we're not kind of tripping over our own feet. We go get in the flow. We love doing it. It creates its own energy. And no one has to say to me now, Miffy, focus on the crochet. Don't let your mind wander off anywhere else. It's like, I'm right there. Time just goes like that, doesn't it? When you really, you're doing something that you love, and you feel you have more energy. It's not that you don't procrastinate about it. You don't, like, all of those things. So this is the kind of thing, but to 100,000%, when you've been able to harness all of that energy in your body, all that blissful energy, and you use that to meditate on emptiness. And so then you have what's called a meditative stabilization generated from bliss that cultivates emptiness. So you meditate on emptiness again and again and again and again. And as you do, then you gradually eliminate attachment, craving, grasping, inherent existence, the, you know, or the view of inherent existence. And that's what frees us from suffering. So this is like a life hack using our body-mind complex. It's far more than just academic thought. It's far more than just ordinary concentration. It's like using the powerhouse of our body and our elements and energies and nervous system to become a machine that helps focus our mind so much more. And how we can tell how far we'll get with this is, what's our pleasure threshold? How much pleasure can we enjoy before we go berserk, before we start grasping at it, wanting more? Another example I can give you about this is, for instance, if you've ever had a good meditation experience and then the next time sat down wanting to repeat it, right there, we've lost it. Because instead of going for what we're really focusing on and the pleasurable experience was a side effect of it, we've gone, now I want the pleasure. And suddenly we're into the worldly view again. So the other analogy is like a vaccine. And I was looking at this. This was like pre-COVID that I put this together. And then I just thought, oh, my God. And then all of the hoo-ha that came in the world about vaccines. But it just shows how human beings were inconsistent, illogical, and irrational. So, but why there is a fear about vaccines actually is very legitimate, because what a vaccine does is it uses disease to produce medicine. So it is actually dangerous. And so, I mean, you know, when the smallpox vaccine was like, that was gruesome how that was invented, you know, scraping off the scabs of your daughter's arm and then putting the pox virus on there and then letting it all fester. And then I don't know if one of the kids died and a few of the others lived, but, you know, it was pretty rudimentary at the beginning, the development of vaccines. And that's because it was actually using a poison, a virus, to make us immune to a virus. And there's the real thing in there, why the tantric approach is different. So what we're doing, we're processing it. It's not that you take the smallpox virus and you give that to the person. It was they took the cowpox virus, wasn't it? A little tiny one, and then it had made you immune to the big one. So in this analogy, what we're doing is we're using all of the energy that arises from bliss and pleasure and enjoying everything that comes in through our senses and every possible blissful experience that we can physically have, and we're processing it with the correct view and the altruistic motive. So we're processing it actually with the three principal aspects of the path. So that's the factory that processes the vaccine and makes sure that it isn't going to kill us. What the factory is, three principal aspects of the path. So whereas a Hinayana approach might be to have a really good diet and just make sure that what we put in is wholesome, we don't put in anything negative. Mahayana Sutra, the approach is you get bitten by a snake, you put in the anti-venom. So you have the affliction and you put in the counterforce. Whereas Mahayana, Tantra is a vaccine. You put in poison to counter poison. It's a really different approach, fundamentally different. So Tantra uses the bliss arising from the desire to counter the affliction of desire. And what this means is Tantra doesn't eliminate the energy of affliction, it harnesses it. So it's really different. And most of the time we're just used to eliminating those negative emotions, to pacifying them, to putting them into equilibrium, rather than kind of like with martial arts, taking the energy and using it. So it's a very different approach. How are we going? Comments, questions? I mean, you can see why it is a path where you say practice caution because of this, because it is easier to go wrong, just like with the vaccine. It is easy, you can go wrong. What I've found actually is that we're so used to trying to counteract our afflictions from the, you know, the perfection vehicle side, like anti-venom, that we forget that the tantric approach is the opposite. It's not quite going with the flow, but it's harnessing that flow. And so why I put all the picture of the pretty bottles down the bottom is that I suppose what happens in our Western culture is it's like we're going into the chemist and we're seeing all of the bottles and everything, and we're going, whoa, like a kid in a candy shop, and just getting the one that looks pretty. And it may not be the right one. And we're just guzzling it and going, yeah, whatever. Without knowing how to take it, knowing which one's the one for us, not just grabbing the nearest bottle or the one that looks great. And so really that's pretty much, you know, quite haphazard approach that we have. We try this technique, we try that. Even just with getting rid of the flu, people say, oh, take garlic or take echinacea or do this or do that, and you tried blah, 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 and you just see it's a very haphazard approach. And we can't have that approach when it comes to Tantra. Well, in the practice of Tantra, you are aiming to achieve calm abiding, and actually it's much quicker to do so, and especially the lower Tantra practices. And so instead of working towards calm abiding from a sutra point of view, working towards calm abiding using a tantric approach is actually much faster. Yeah, you're still practicing. So you can practice Tantra without having shamatha or calm abiding. The whole point is to achieve calm abiding, but through a tantric technique. And that's why, to ensure that we don't get into trouble, we need those three principal aspects of the path. Renunciation, like number one. Three principal aspects of the path: renunciation, bodhicitta, correct view. So we looked at that on our first class. Yeah. So renunciation is the first one, and then bodhicitta and correct view. That's the terms. They sound quite dry. So renunciation really means the work for oneself, and bodhicitta, the work for others, and the correct view, that's what makes it Buddhist. That's the wisdom realizing emptiness. Aha, here we are. Here's your answer, June. So we've got the differences. So I found this little picture here. So we've got four classes of Tantra, and normally we talk about action Tantra, which is the lower classes of Tantra. And then we also talk about highest yoga Tantra. And what differentiates them is what capacity we have to take bliss onto the path without getting into trouble, without going berserk. There are the other two classes of Tantra, but they're not often talked about. Generally, everything that we need to know and practice are in the lower Tantras, and we get a foundation in that, and then we can do the biggies, highest yoga Tantra. So there's a couple of caveats. So if countries modernize too quickly, they get into trouble. If things happen too fast, you can get all of this new technology and everything and go wow, and it backfires on us. We're not ready. If we don't have those three principal aspects of the path, if we haven't planned, it can backfire on us. The other thing is, on a much more personal level, how do we tell if, you know, without getting into trouble? I'm really interested in art, and there are many stories of great painters, and many of those great painters have been men, and many of them have had outrageous affairs and terrible relationships. And I've been thinking what happens here is that when you are really very accomplished at doing something, like if you're a really fantastic painter and you get in the zone, as with anything, it's a blissful experience because your sense of self, it dissolves. You're in the zone, you become, you know, a much more unified kind of entity. And so naturally, your state of mind is blissful, but also blissful feelings arise in the body. And if you don't have a method to deal with that, what you do is you just go chase women. Whereas when all those blissful feelings start arising in the body, if then you could actually put that back into your art, you'd be an even better painter. Not many painters did that. They didn't have the discipline, or they didn't even know that was the thing to do. But the painters that did that actually focused it to have an artistic breakthrough. So this is what the English Geshe Tashi Sering says. We can harness pleasurable experiences, but we can harness any afflictive emotion on the path. So here's an example of the opposite one. Say, for instance, anger. We can go into the situation that made us angry, and then we meditate on emptiness while in that situation. So instead of going into a blissful situation, and sometimes it's easier to do it with something that is less enjoyable because we've got more incentive to work with it. Our understanding of emptiness will stop the anger, but not the energy. We then bring that energy into the process of visualization. This is more profound than doing a meditation on developing compassion and love for an enemy. There, we're trying to destroy the anger by replacing it with its antidote, love. Such a practice can be effective with or without understanding emptiness. But with an understanding of emptiness, rather than eliminating the anger and its energy, we can transform it into something powerful. So again, it's just like with the desirous energy, rather than eliminating it, counteracting it, we transform it into something really powerful. So this then, the four classes of Tantra. So there is a worksheet on this in your notes as well. This is more a simplified version of it. So what we have that shows us what amount that we can take without getting into trouble. We've got Action Tantra, which is Kriya Tantra in the Sanskrit. Performance Tantra and Yoga Tantra, which are the middle ones. And then Highest Yoga Tantra, Maha Anuttara Yoga. So they're the four classes of Tantra, and all of the tantric practices fall into here. Then the capacity, so the next column here, the lesser capacity student, it's very good to start there. That's something that we could all aim at. Middling supreme, highest capacity, we really have to have our three principal aspects of the path well and truly ensconced in our mind. Now, how they're disciplined, for Action Tantra, the lower tantras, the main way that we tame and discipline our mind is actually by taming and disciplining our body. So it's physical activities. So cleanliness, diet, not eating the wrong foods, really good posture, And this is because it's the easiest approach. If you sit up really straight and you act as if you're really together and confident and your shoulders are, you know, you start feeling like that. It's a life hack. If you're all like slammed and then it's very, very, very difficult to start feeling confident. So it's the easy way for the lesser capacity. And so the main practices for Action Tantra that we're familiar with are nyungnaes. So has anyone here done nyungnaes? Yvette! Oh my gosh, you'll have to do a nyungnae. I know Demi online, she's done nyungnaes. Sue's done nyungnaes. Have you done nyungnaes, Alison? No. Whole bunch of newies. So at first you hear about nyungnaes and you think, oh my God, this is impossible. But actually it's much easier to act it all out, to act as if you're together. And then the mind slowly follows. And even in nyungnaes, that's where you learn to do the mudras. And so at the beginning, if you're learning the mudras, your hands are like this, like they're all over the show. And everything feels really jerky and whatever. And it's because that's how our energy is. And then as you practice the mudras and as you get more focused, you'll just notice that your hands become more contained and less jerking around. And as that happens, it's like doing Tai Chi. You actually start feeling the energy and you're able to harness it. So it's a little bit like when I was learning to drive, and I noticed like when people that can drive, they hold the steering wheel and they do this, you know, it's all really smooth. But when I was driving, like, whoa, whoa, poor driving instructor, he actually had to put the brake on his side because like overcompensating this way, that way. So that's how we are with doing the mudras at first. It's like that. We're learning to drive and we're just all over the show. And then slowly, slowly you start going till you just do these tiny, fine little adjustments because all. So that's the way that this lesser capacity being is how we discipline ourselves. So you start there and then you build up. So how the analogy goes is this kind of universal progression that we have in a relationship. And so the type of list that we take, so on Action Tantra, is just the kind of enjoyment that we have when we just gaze at the beloved. So if you think back to when you're a teenager, did you ever have pictures of rock stars on your wall or poets or, you know, someone, blue tech there, everybody, sports heroes, whoever, you know, this whole array of who we wanted to be like. And just gazing at their photo was fantastic and so inspiring. So I had Wonder Woman, I had Janis Joplin, I had David Bowie, I had the Dalai Lama, you know, big mix, Frida Kahlo. So I like the idea of a band analogy because if you've got a crush on a rock star, like I had a crush on David Bowie and I had a picture of David Bowie on the wall. But as we know, if you actually meet David Bowie, like what happens? All of the teeny boppers at the airport, they're just screaming, just losing their mind. Total hysteria. So what you can take, the type of bliss you can take on the path for Action Tantra is the joy of gazing, and that's it. Anything else just sends you into hysteria. And that's okay, that's enough, because that's inspiring enough and we harness that energy. With Performance Tantra, it's like you take the joy of gazing and smiling back and forth. So that's like when you're at the rock concert and you're in the third row and then they look at you and they sing the song to you. Oh, my God. It's like you're the most special person in the whole world. And so you might actually enjoy that without fainting and, you know, falling off your chair and going hysterical. But I've seen videos of the Beatles, right? And I'm just like, what is going on here with all of these 13-year-old girls in the, I mean, that is just weird. So can you take that? Can you actually enter into this wonderful experience of them singing to you and you, you know, vibing back as the audience and not lose your mind? So yes, it could be possible. But then if you manage to get backstage and then you talk to them, so the joy of gazing, of smiling back and forth, maybe holding hands and saying hello. And so if you've ever met, have you ever met a rock star or someone and been just totally stage struck and they go, hello, how are you? What's your name? And you go, and you can't remember your name?
Yes.
So it's like another level, isn't it? We can have the photo of them on the wall. We can even have like ask a question in class, or they sing to us or something like that, or maybe write an email. But then we actually have an interaction. We shake hands and they say, hi, how are you? What do you do? And you've got no idea. Your mind has gone. Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I got stuck on the I was existentially stuck. What is my name? What is a name anyway? I mean, that was kind of the blessing of the guru to even have that question. What's in a name? Who am I? But it was a bit funny because, you know, they're going down the line and shake everyone's hand at the airport and I'm just like... So when something is really profound and intense and deeply meaningful, we don't know what our response is going to be. And what it's going to depend on is a whole lot of background and preparation and practice. So maybe, you know, maybe we see, maybe we say hello and we go, hi, my name's Miffy. What's your name? It's like, well, I'm David Bowie. Oh, good, nice to meet you. And maybe you get it together and maybe you can say, would you like a cup of tea? Come to dinner. So you might be able to have that kind of interaction without losing your mind. And so here, you know, how the disciple is disciplined, it's not so much external activities now. Now it's mainly concentration. So that's that presence of mind. So instead of just going through the motions and practicing, now it's really internalized. And you have that equilibrium and that presence of mind. Then highest yoga tantra, to continue this analogy, this is when you actually get into bed. And so you consummate the relationship. So it's a huge difference from just shaking someone's hand hello to jumping into bed. And so the type of bliss that you take, the bliss of union, the bliss of orgasm, onto the path to be able to do that without losing your mind, now that's hard. That is difficult to do. So that is the highest capacity. And that's not relying on anything external. And that means that there's nothing higher than this, but it also means that you're not at all attached to that physical experience. You're not attached to the bliss. You're using the bliss. That's the only way it can happen. The moment you start grasping after the bliss, it's all over. Yes. So what it is, I know it sounds very mysterious. So the practices of Action Tantra are, for instance, the practices like Great Chenrezig over here. So most of the Action Tantra deities are singular. They're just the one deity. And so their wisdom mother or wisdom father is implicit, but not depicted there. So yeah, so with no, you're not gazing at the deity, but what if you've had the full initiation, then you arise as this deity, but it's a singular deity. Yes, you arise as the deity and you do the practices as the deity. So so this is with a full tantric initiation. So last week we talked about whether it was a full initiation or just a permission to practice to say the mantra. So
just like everything in the Lam Rim is taught from the point of view of Tantra, actually everything within Tantra is kind of taught from the point of view of highest yoga Tantra. So within all of these practices, implicitly is the union of masculine and feminine. And are the practices of using the blissful energies in the body. But it's implicit, it's not explicit. It's just kind of coming at it from the edges. So you have great Chenrezig there, but you don't have the wisdom mother there. And you have Aryatara there, green Tara, but you don't have the wisdom father. So the lower Tantra deities are singular like this, and some are wrathful emanations, some are blissful emanations, some are powerful emanations, all the different aspects of enlightenment.
Just these six?
No, there's thousands. Thousands. However many people on the planet, there are probably that many deities. But these are the ones that are the ones we're more familiar with. So Medicine Buddha, Blue Medicine Buddha, Great Chenrezig, they're both lower Tantra, Action Tantra deities. Vajrasattva on the bottom left corner, Buddha of Purification. So that's an Action Tantra deity of Vajrasattva. So holding the Vajra, just singular. Then there is Mahakala there, the wrathful form of Chenrezig, great compassion. Tara, Manjushri. So in the path of the practice, there is a mention of, say, for instance, the wisdom mother, but that's it. But then when we have highest yoga Tantra, then it becomes explicit. So up here we have white Vajrasattva with the wisdom mother. So now it's explicit, masculine and feminine energies together. With Tara and also with Vajrayogini, even though they're depicted singular, Vajrayogini has a staff with all these special things on it. And that actually represents the father. So it's there more explicitly. Then Kala Chakra, Higher Griva. So here the union is far more explicit, and it's depicted and has all the meaning. So the meaning is there in the lower tantras, but it's not explicit. And actually, so for those of you who've done Nyungnaes, so Nyungnaes on Great Chenrezig, the Buddha of Compassion, and often it's depicted as being Action Tantra. But actually, in the practice of Nyungne, you have the meditation there where you have the thousand-arm Chenrezig, and then at his heart is two-arm Chenrezig. And then at his heart is the syllable Hri. So it's kind of like going in more and more subtle levels. They're not separate beings, it's just looking at different levels, like through a microscope on different levels. And so the Chenrezig practice is actually, it's got aspects of performance Tantra in there. It's got, so just like when you look at biology and you go, where's the demarcation between one species or another? Where's the demarcation between fish and corals? Are they alive? Are they plants? Like, once you start looking in deep, you can't find the demarcation. So the same with Action Tantra and Performance Tantra, you can't actually find the demarcation because there's aspects of Performance Tantra in the Nyungne practice, in Chenrezig practice. And so then actually you could say it's a Performance Tantra practice because it has these more explicit elements. But actually they're all hinting at further elements all the way to highest yoga Tantra. So what it is, it's like a gradual revealing of all the different layers of the practice.
But when it comes to highest yoga tantra, everything is explicit. It's all there. It's all spelt out. All the meditations, all the mudras, all the working with the chakras and the energies in the body, actually doing it. You're not just approximating it. You're not kind of there from the outside. You're actually working with it. So it's like the difference from being outside of the power plant enjoying the electricity to being inside the power plant, opening up the toolbox and fiddling around with everything in there. It's a really big difference. Either way, you enjoy the electricity. Yeah, so there are similarities. So with Hinduism, the way the types of offerings that you have, all of that, you're using all of that, and you have the sound and the smells and the lights and everything. So you offer all of those. The Buddhist offerings are different because you remember that they're in the nature of emptiness. So that adds a different aspect. But also as, when it comes to tantric practice, for instance, you know, like when we chant together, it's a nice experience. It's like being in a choir. It's a nice experience. And then Western science has discovered, you know, that our heart rates all synchronize, and that's and all the endorphins are released, and so we get the good feelings. We actually literally are creating harmony with our voice, but by doing so, we're harmonizing as embodied beings. So by harmonizing our bodies and all of our heartbeats sync going in unison, then we harmonize as human beings. So the thing is that what it's doing is it's harnessing a physical experience of our heartbeats synchronizing and endorphins in our brain, and that physical experience triggers an emotional experience, an experience of the mind. And then now we feel we're among friends, we live harmoniously, we're open, we're relaxed. So it's taking a physical thing to direct the mind. So that's also what Buddhist Tantra does. It takes a physical thing of working with those physical energies in the body, with your heartbeat, with your endorphins, with your nervous system, with your chakras, to like trigger your mind to meditate on emptiness. And how are you going to remember to do that? Because what's your pleasure threshold? So the next time, like, you smell the delicious smell or you listen to the beautiful music, it's like, is that going to trigger your wisdom realizing emptiness? That's what we want it to do every single time. And if we get into that habit now with just these ordinary things, then when it comes to working with the actual physical energies in our body, we'll be able to do so. Meaning just food and music and yeah.
Like music.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's right. But with everything, anything that you enjoy doing, have it, try and associate it as a trigger for an inner experience rather than getting more into the outer experience. And just getting that habit will then set us up. That's like this one of being disciplined on the external activities. It's much easier to remember when you're doing something really nice. You just get that set up there, it'll set you up for the whole rest of it. Well, being in the moment, but using the moment, not just enjoying the moment. That's not enough, because then the moment is over and you've used up that bit of good karma.
It's an action towards.
So that's like thought transformation. So it's similar. It's a basis of it. So every action that we do, instead of it just being ordinary, so like here, when we put the chairs out, instead of just putting the chairs out, it's like I'm putting out thrones for future Buddhas. No, so that one, that's like the everyday Dharma thought transformation. And so then we turn the mind around with our emotions too. So when you experience suffering, may I take on the suffering of all sentient beings and they be free of it. When you experience happiness, delicious food, wonderful dinner,
may everybody have the sustenance of the Dharma. So we get used to using it rather than grasping after it. And with thought transformation, when we have pain, then we get used to using that pain to develop our compassion. Because we really don't develop our compassion without it. I mean, who sits there going, oh, I feel really good today, I think I'll develop my compassion. No. So all of that process sets us up for the tantric approach, which is using the same process, but now on our physical elements. So that would be, you could say, practicing the future result now.
Yeah.
So you taste the food, all the enjoyment, you send out as blissful light to all sentient beings that enlightens them. And at the same time that you're tasting the food, you're meditating on emptiness, recognizing that this actually the food isn't making me feel like this, it's the strength of my virtue, it's all the little atoms that are going onto the taste buds, that are going into the brain is interpreting, putting through a cultural spectrum, all of this stuff. So it triggers our wisdom realizing emptiness and our bliss. The altruistic intention is what will remind us to use it. And then how we use it, well, what we can start with is the thought transformation techniques, just every day, instead of having ordinary experiences, using the ordinary experiences to trigger us for an enlightened activity. Instead of trigger us like, oh, trauma, to get triggered up, develop my compassion, develop my patience, everything that happens, recognize how it's happened interdependently, all the steps that made it up, how it doesn't exist inherently. So that whatever happens now triggers your wisdom instead of triggering your grasping at inherence. So that's the background. If we can harness that, if that becomes a habit, then when we sit down and we meditate and all those physical and mental blissful experiences arise, we will naturally be able to harness them. But that isn't going to come naturally if we haven't done the practice beforehand. So like in that flowchart where you become a blissful entity and then you meditate on emptiness. So it's both mental and physical bliss. And so we have to get used to every time we experience something good, it triggers us to meditate on emptiness and compassion. So again, it's like whatever arises, it can be anger energy, it can be pain, it can be pleasure, it can be any of these things. It triggers us to develop our all of these qualities rather than us trying to put a lid on them. So in summary, four classes of Tantra. What determines what kind of class it is how much bliss we can handle before getting into trouble. Just think of those tinny boppers. The difference between ordinary and enlightened desire, or ordinary pleasure and the enlightened experience. So everything that we experience within the tantric path actually destroys the affliction. But we're using the poison to destroy the poison. Or like the white ants, we're sustaining ourselves by destroying the affliction. And Lama Yeshe says, we've got this unlimited source of male and female energy that is as profound as the energy in an atom, that we can harness this. And, you know, all that energy that just comes from this tiny, tiny little atom, that explosive enlightened energy, we've got it, the potential for that right here in our human body. And our deity practice is a mirror of our enlightened potential. So this is really nice. Whenever we see the images of the deities, any kind of resonance that we have with them, it's like a mirror of what we ourselves can become. It's not out there. So the reading, in the notes, the four tantras, page 32, four levels of attachment, page 33. And now the next class that we have will be on, let's see, power of visualization, a little bit about neuroscience and quantum physics, and the four Buddha bodies, the four kayas. But that's actually in 2 weeks because next week I'm away. So what's happening, Venerable Larsam is coming. So she is a graduate of the master's program. She's like, you know, she might look like a little meek little old lady, but no, she knows a lot. And so we'll show the video, Introduction to Tantra, and pause every now and again and you can ask her questions. Yeah, Larsam will be here, sitting where I am, and we'll online as we'll figure out how to show the video simultaneously here and there. Me and Alison, we're going to do an experiment. So we don't.
According to my diet,
really? Uh oh.
Do we want to
check? Have a, no, let me just check.
Yeah. Is less than the 60s?
Ah, oh, you're right.
Have we got another week?
We do.
We need to do some, no?
No, we do, we do.
The 25th and...
What day are we? Yeah, sorry, I'm a week ahead. Ha, ha, ha. I don't know where I am.
Sorry.
No, you're right.
You've got 2 weeks to do
the Thank you. We've got 2 weeks to do the experiment. Oh, today, phew.
Today's the 9th. Because next week is the 16th.
Yeah. No, I'm a week ahead of myself.
We're doing a big thing up there. Yep.
Yeah, no, that's right. You're right. No, I'm a week ahead. So next week is as it says, and then the week after is Venerable Larsam.
So I might need to, depending on what I'm doing up there, do it online.
Do it online, so yeah.
I'm just going to look after some things up there.
Yep.
The
yes, yes, so sorry to put the cat amongst the pigeons there. Oh, that woke you all up.
I thought I'd just stop you right there.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know what week I'm up to. So let's dedicate. So when we dedicate, we're actually dedicating everything on the path to full enlightenment for all sentient beings. Lama Sangye Droi Gyoenim Droi Chi Kyan Mai Lupai Dei Salai Gopai Shun Chan Chu Sem Chorin Poi Chi Ma Kya Panan Ki Gyo Chi Kya Wa Nyam Pa Me Pa Yam Gone Kuntu Pa Wa Shun.